to The Apologist by the Cantaro Institute, a podcast for the advancement of the Christian philosophy of life. Your host is Christian thinker and Institute Director Stephen R. Martins.
Welcome to another episode of The Apologist. If you've been following our podcast since we started, you'll notice that we set the foundation with our past three episodes covering the apologetic mandate, the biblical methodology. We're covering content that you'd find in greater detail in my book, Apologetics, Studies in Biblical Apologetics for a Christian Worldview. And you'll notice that a recurring theme has been the comprehensiveness of the gospel. And as a result of the comprehensiveness of the gospel, of the Christian philosophy of life, our apologetic has to be comprehensive in turn, in the sense of covering all the bases. We're talking about a world and life view. We're talking about an apologetic for a Christian view of all things. And so if we're talking about government, for example, then we need to talk about an apologetic for a Christian view of government. We're talking about marriage, then we have an apologetic for a Christian view of marriage. We're talking about economics, then we're talking about a Christian view of economics. The defense of the faith deals with much more than just isolated or specialized historical facts and artifacts. The defense of the faith concerns itself with the defense of the Christian world and life view as the only rational worldview there is. And that means that as a worldview, the Christian defense is multifaceted and wonderfully complex. Now, on the matter of the comprehensiveness of our worldview, I wanted to bring to our attention a book that the Cantaro Institute published earlier this year by Michael Wagner, and it's titled The Anglosphere's Broken Covenant, Rediscovering the Validity and Importance of the Solemn League and Covenant. And for those who are not familiar with Michael Wagner, Dr. Wagner, I call him Michael because he's a dear friend of mine. He presently serves as the senior Alberta Alberta columnist for the Western Standard and the Alberta Report based in the city of Edmonton. Also worth mentioning is that Dr. Wagner has a PhD in political science from the University of Alberta, and he has authored several other books. And I'm starting off here with his brief bio because, as a matter of fact, I have him with us today for our podcast. How are you doing, Michael?
Very good, thanks. Thank you for having me on.
Our pleasure to have you with us. And I'm just really excited with your book. I've gone through it, I've edited it, I've read it, and really encouraged to see its reception earlier this year. I believe you had sent a copy down to Douglas Wilson down in Moscow, Idaho, and he provided a very glowing review of your book. I guess I wanted to get the ball rolling here, Michael, and just ask you, what led you to first write this book?
Well, like the book, as you mentioned, is about the Solemn League and Covenant, which I consider to be one of the most significant events in the history of the English-speaking nations, and especially for Christians. And it's something that I hadn't heard about. Like, I became a Christian, you know, in the 1980s, and it wasn't for about 10 years later that I'd even heard about the Solemn League and Covenant. And when people were first talking to me about it, I thought, well, this is such a significant thing that they're making it out to be. I didn't believe it could be so significant, right? How could something so significant not be common knowledge? You know, you'd think this is the kind of thing that would be more common knowledge, especially among Bible-believing Christians. So I was looking into myself and I was thinking, wow, like, this is a significant thing. I mean, I was actually at the University of Alberta at that time researching something else, but I was also taking time on the side to look further into this. And it really became apparent that the Solemn League and Covenant, the taking of that covenant by, you know, England, Scotland, and Ireland, was a very significant historical event. And it was just not common knowledge to people. And so I wanted to kind of reintroduce it, if that's the way to put it. I mean, during the 17th and 18th centuries, there were still plenty of people who knew about it and wrote about it. But in our time, it's become forgotten. So it was very important for me to be able to have a brief introduction. That's the thing. Sometimes I don't want to explain it to somebody. And, it could be a complex subject, but I wanted to make something very brief and to the point and say, you know, here's this covenant. This is what it's about. You know, just so that people can find out about it for the first time and they can start to think about it for them for the first time and see if they believe it's also significant. So I wanted a small introduction just to give to people so that they could, you know, find out about it for the first time to reintroduce the idea of the Solemn League and Covenant, hoping that more and more people would accept it or be interested in it. And perhaps it could lead to a revival in some sense if enough people, you know, saw that this was a binding obligation that we needed to return to as nations. So I was hoping to help, you know, to spark, you know, spiritual interest in this, basically.
Yeah, as I've looked at the content of the book, and I think it's a very valuable contribution to, I would say, cultural apologetics today, in the sense that when we do talk about our Christian worldview and we do talk about the Christian understanding and perspective of all things within reality, this book comes in handy because we understand that we're not in sort of a vacuum. We're not in some sort of non-religious context. There is a religious context, a religious historical context to where we are today, where our nations have come. And it sort of reminds me in a way, I mean, it's a small booklet. It's not as big as Augustine's City of God, of course. But it does remind me in that sort of same way where we're looking at things from a sort of nation building perspective, a sort of a vast macro level of how our faith speaks into everything we do and how it relates to everything we do. I was exposed to the very reality or the historical event of the Solemn League and Covenant a few years ago when I was began first studying cultural apologetics. But something that I often had struggled with early on was this whole idea of covenanting. Like we see a lot of that in the Bible. We see a lot of that in the Old Testament. And the sort of common questions that come up is, you know, is covenanting still something that carries on today, or is covenanting something that is only for the past? How do we come to understand that?
Well, like when we look at the particular scriptural examples of covenanting that the British Church, you know, copied with the Solemn League and Covenant, the examples are primarily from the Old Testament. Like, for example, there's King Asa in 2 Corinthians, you know, where he kind of leads a revival and the people take a covenant. Also in 2 Corinthians, sorry, did I say Corinthians? 2 Chronicles, Josiah, there's also a revival and King Josiah leads the people in a covenant. So the specific examples of national covenanting do come from the Old Testament. Like, we don't have in the New Testament a specific example of national covenanting, but I don't think that's a problem for a number of reasons. For one, these particular approved examples from the Old Testament are not abrogated in the New Testament. Like, there's no theology or teaching of the New Testament that abrogates the idea of national covenanting. And then beyond that, I think we can look at Romans 13, where God, you know, institutes the civil magistrate, the institution of the civil magistrate. It talks about the civil magistrate being a minister of God for good, who punishes the evil and praises the good. So the civil magistrate is supposed to be a minister of God. And so when he looks to determine what's evil and what's good, so he can punish the evil and praise the good, he has to look to the Bible, because that's God's standard for good and evil. So you have a minister of God, the civil magistrate. He's going to look to the Bible for good and evil, for examples of how he's supposed to rule. And as he looks in the Bible, he will see approved examples from the Old Testament about ways of, you know, leading his society towards God. I mean, right now, of course, when we look at political rulers around the world, we don't really see them that are trying to really fulfill that office of minister of God. But that is that is how God has established it, and that's kind of the ideal. That would be the Christian ideal of what a civil government should look like, would be this minister of God who's ruling, you know, according to God's law, according to what God says is good and evil. And he has these approved examples of the Old Testament. So for me, like, I'm a political scientist, so I tend to look at these things more politically than other people might. There's the approved example for the civil magistrate of Romans 13 as to how he should rule a Christian society. But like, if we take it out of the political realm and just kind of a more personal realm, you know, you think of Joshua saying, you know, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now, that's not an explicit covenant per se. But it's like within that realm, like, you've got oaths, vows, and covenants. And I couldn't give you a specific definition of how one, you know, differs from the other, but they're all kind of within a family of, you know, publicly saying, I commit myself before God to follow this way. So when Joshua said, you know, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, He said that as a head of a household, as a father. And there are many Christians today who, you know, would same use that same phrase for themselves. And so in that sense, they're implicitly recognizing the continuity of the idea of covenanting a father, covenanting on behalf of his family. And, you know, there's other examples of that, like in many churches, like when a church officer is installed, he'll have to take oaths and vows, you know, to serve the Lord, right? And actually, one of the recent examples I found was quite interesting. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the movie Courageous. It's the best Christian movie that I've ever seen. And part of the theme of that movie, there's a father who loses a daughter and he wants to become a better father. And so he does that by writing out his obligations as a father. He calls it the resolution, and he shows it to his friends, and they all want to take it too. So they have a public ceremony where these men stand before a pastor who reads them the resolution, and they publicly declare before God and before the church that they are going to be better fathers. They're going to fulfill the responsibility as fathers. When I saw that, I said, you know, that is covenanting. Like, that is a public covenant. They don't call it that in the movie, and that's fine. I mean, you don't have to call it that. It's not matter what you call it. It's a matter of fulfilling the duty that these men, as fathers, were acknowledging before God and the public that I will fulfill my duty as a father. And so that is public covenanting. So I think that the idea of public covenanting among Christians is probably still there, but not necessarily the terminology. You know what I mean? So if a father can take a covenant on behalf of his family, and say church elders can take covenants on behalf of the church in terms of obeying God. So, I mean, God created these three institutions, right? The family, the church, and the state. If it's okay in the family and it's okay in the church still, you know, by implication, should be okay in the state as well. So I think the idea is still there in the New Testament, even though we don't have the explicit national covenanting in the New Testament. We still have the examples of personal covenanting and so on. And so I think it's you know, it's the whole Bible teaches the same thing in terms of covenanting as far as I can see that way. So I hope that's a proper explanation of what I'm trying to say here.
that's really helpful, and that does help me lead into my next question. So now that kind of provides us a bit of a basic overview, understanding of covenanting, the very nature of covenanting, and we don't see any evidence of covenanting being abolished in the New Testament. Now, you know, for someone who's hearing this and it's like, well, this is my very first time I've ever heard about the Solemn League and Covenant, and I've heard you kind of already kind of speak a little bit about it, but it seems like you're almost presupposing how much we know about it. What could you say in a short, summarized way, without going into every little component of the Solemn League and Covenant, but what would you say is kind of the gist? What's communicated in that covenant? What was the central message behind and the commitment that was made in this covenant?
Okay, yeah. Well, the Solemn League and Covenant was taken in 1643 by the civil governments and the churches of England, Scotland, and Ireland. So what these nations were covenanting to do was they wanted to, I mean, if you read it, it's they wanted first and foremost to serve God as nations and as individuals. They wanted to commit their nations to God. They wanted to have their nations, you know, ruled in accordance with the law of God, and the churches governed in accordance with the law of God. And they were making this for their nations and their posterity. I just want to throw in a bit of history for this, you know, to give it a context. Scotland, you know, of the different Protestant nations, Scotland was the one that took up the doctrine of covenanting the strongest. So Scotland made a national covenant in 1581. Then they renewed that covenant in 1638. And this actually is related to the Solemn League Covenant in the sense that, you know, Scotland had a Presbyterian government and England had a king who's actually was also king of Scotland, but he was the head of the Church of England, which was the Anglican Church. This was King Charles I. He wanted to impose Anglican rites and rituals on the Scottish Presbyterian Church, and the Scottish said no. So there was a lot of conflict there. And in the context of the conflict between Scotland and England, the Scottish renewed their national covenant in 1638, and there was a revival essentially, and the country really strongly turned to God. Then the English Parliament was dominated by Puritans, and King Charles I didn't like that. So there was conflict between the Parliament and Charles, and the English Civil War broke out between Parliament and Charles. So the Parliament of England was a natural ally with Scotland against Charles I because they were both in conflict with him. So they went to Scotland, the Parliament of England went to Scotland and said, let's have a, you know, a military political alliance against King Charles. The Scots said, well, we're willing to do that, but we've got to have a religious aspect to it. We have to commit ourselves also to God in that. So the English agreed, and Scotland and the English Parliament then created the Solemn League and Covenant. And so that was kind of the formation of it in that context, historical context. To make a long story short, King Charles I lost the war. He was executed by the English Parliament. Charles II then wanted Scottish support for the throne. And so Charles II, then he actually swore the Solemn League and Covenant. So both the House of Lords and the House of Commons and the King had all sworn the Solemn League and Covenant. So it fulfilled, you know, what was required to be fully enforced in every way. Now, the sad thing is once King Charles II came into force, it turned out he was a deceiver, or we came into power story. And so he overturned the covenant, and then he started persecuting the people who believed it, which were called the Covenanters. And I mean, the knowledge of the persecution of the Covenanters in the 1600s is probably the best known aspect of the covenant history. Like many Christians know of the Covenanters, they were martyrs for the faith. And that was because King Charles II turned against the covenant after he had taken it and started essentially persecuting those who wanted to uphold the covenant. So I hope I didn't go too long, but there is important historical background to why the Solemn Covenant was there and what it was meant to do. Sorry, so I'm getting off track here a bit, but.
Oh no, that's totally fine. Yeah, if you're absolutely free to keep on going into it. But someone might say, look, this Solemn League and Covenant, we can might be able to grant that this was something that was done by the United Kingdom before the Lord. But you know, how does this relate to the rest of the Anglosphere, right? So you do have a section in your book where you talk about, well, this is, doesn't just apply to the United Kingdom. It applies to all the sort of children that have come as a result of the United Kingdom's, we could call it expansion, so to speak, over the years. So maybe you can speak a word on that and explain, how is this relevant to Canada? How is this relevant to the United States? How is this relevant to like Australia, et cetera?
That's a very, very important question. I think that's one of the main questions that comes up. I mean, many Christians are willing to say, yes, we can see that the Solemn League Covenant applies to Britain because they're explicitly mentioned there. So why would I say that also these other countries would be under the Solemn League Covenant? Well, the thing is that those people, you know, the British people, they took the covenant. I mean, it was taken in a widespread kind of a way. Then some of those people who were under the covenant obligation left their country to found new countries. So, you know, taking the United States as an example, here you have British, settlers. They come from Britain. They settle. They create a new country. But because they've left Britain geographically does not mean they lose their covenant bonds. I mean, the part of the covenant is among the nations, but the main feature of the covenant, the core of it, is a covenant with God. So if you have a covenant with God in a particular geographical location, if you step out of that geographical location, you don't lose that connection with God. Your connection with God is still there. So you have these covenant-bound people who've come to North America. They found the United States. Essentially, you know, another group of people come to Canada from Britain and found Canada, Australia, New Zealand. These countries were all essentially started by settlers who were bound by the Solemn League Covenant themselves. And because the covenant is with God, that covenant carries with them and for their descendants and their posterity. And so that's kind of essentially the, in a nutshell, why I would say these countries are also bound by the covenant. And, you know, when you look at it, and I explain this a bit in the book, when those settlers came from Britain and went to, say, the United States or Australia or Canada, they brought with them the British culture, the language, the religion, and the law and the constitutional structures. They brought all these things with them. And so if they bring those things with them, how could they not also bring the religious obligations that they had taken with them? I mean, the Solemn League Covenant, in a sense, was part of the constitutional law of Britain. So when you bring that constitution over and those principles, you've got that covenant bond in there as well. So, and I mean, some people from the United States say, well, I can see how that applies to Canada and Australia, but not the United States, because we broke off our connection with Britain. True, they did break off their connection with Britain. But again, the central idea of the covenant is obligations towards God and not the obligations towards a political entity. So regardless, if a person, you know, takes a covenant, as I mentioned, in a particular geographical location and then moves somewhere else, they still have that covenant obligation with God. So say someone moves from Britain, say to France. Well, France is not under the covenant. That's a completely different, you know, geographical expression and cultural and historical. But that person as an individual is still under their covenant obligations. They don't make that nation under, but they as a person, they still maintain it. But when a group of people go and they form a brand new community and they all had the covenant obligation to begin with, their new community takes on that characteristic of having, you know, that covenant obligation. So that's why I think these particular Anglosphere nations are also under the, you know, the obligation of the Solemn League Covenant in the sense that they are supposed to obey God. Like there are historical details in the Solemn League Covenant that no longer apply. But again, the central idea is obligation to God, serving God and living according to his word. And, you know, it's fine if there's a historical situation that has changed and you don't have to, you know, take that into account. But the obligation is first and foremost with God and not with these other details, so to speak.
Well, Michael, we're so privileged to be able to publish this book by you, The Anglosphere's Broken Covenant. And for those who are listening and want to know where they can order a copy, you can visit our website, cantaroinstitute.org, and head over to press, and you'll find underneath there Cantaro Publications and a full list of our publications, those that are already out, those that are scheduled to come out soon. We're trying to add as many titles as we can gradually from various different authors and even some historical pieces as well. You'll find there the Anglosphere's Broken Covenant, the product page where you can find where you can buy yourself a copy. And this episode should be landing before Christmas time. So hopefully there's enough time for you to pick it up for Christmas reading, or at least over the New Year's. Definitely worth worth checking out. Michael, there's another book that you wrote actually that when I first met you quite a few years back, I picked up your book, Leaving God Behind, the Charter of Rights and Canada's Official Rejection of Christianity. And I remember I brought it with me over a week-long vacation. If I remember correctly, it was about almost 8 years ago that I picked up that book, and I was on a cruise ship with my wife, and she was asking, what books did you bring to read over the week? And I said, that was the first book I brought out, and the kind of the reaction was like, what a negative read to read over vacation. It really was, because it was just, wow, I can't believe how far Canada has fallen. We've departed from our Christian social order. We have seen such a dramatic apostatization of our culture. And the more I read it, the more my heart turned, and the more it wrenched within me that my spirit just be able to see how truth was sacrificed on the altar in the West for the sake of the selfish religion. This, I believe, it's selfism is what people have been calling it. But it's just incredible to see the religious demographic over the course of the years, and then the cultural direction everything has taken. And it's not quite easy. It's not that easy to kind of map out everything, because particularly here in the Canadian context, might be a bit different in the US, but in the Canadian context, you're well aware of the influx of different religious worldviews as a result of the unique multi-ethnic demographic that Canada has in terms of new Canadians, immigrants, and so forth. And so we really do live in a pluralist society. And when I read your book, and then when I read the Anglosphere's Broken Covenant, and I said, look where we had come from. And I think that's the notion there was at first was, well, would it be nice to return to that? But there's sort of like a caution, a word of caution that needs to be raised to that, because returning to that also means adopting the same errors and mistakes that were committed at the time. And I appreciate what Douglas Wilson had to say in one of his podcast interviews. And he was saying, you look at Christendom, you see all the good things that came from Christendom, and the response not is is not to recreate that, because you'd be recreating the same errors and issues and mistakes. The idea would be to take what is good and to correct and learn from history and what we've done wrong, and moving towards that direction where we can make things right, where we can, he calls it a Christendom 2.0, right? Guided by the truth of God's word. And I guess in light of that, what might you have to say in regards to the future of Canada? What do you think we should bear in mind? Should we have hope?
Well, I believe we should have hope. Actually, I so much agree with what you were just saying, and the importance of, a future Christendom avoiding the errors of the past. I mean, we can look back at the past, at our forefathers, and how much they had, and what they gave us in terms of our heritage, because the freedoms that we continue to enjoy today, and the economic prosperity we can continue to enjoy today, are the momentum that were given to us by our forefathers. So they gave us so much in terms of our Christian heritage, but like you say, there were errors there. And so when we talk about the need for returning to a Christian heritage, it doesn't mean returning to the errors. I mean, we can look back and see where we can improve. I mean, in looking towards a future Christianization of the country, we'd want to evolve, we'd want to avoid those kinds of errors and things. But like I am hopeful for the future. I think because I think that God ultimately will triumph by his spirit. But when, if I can, I'm just going to pick a few things you mentioned here, if you don't mind. Like when you brought up leaving God behind, there is a small connection between that and the Anglosphere's Broken Covenant. And that is, there are people who still deny that an independent country can carry over laws and court principles from other countries. And so one of the things I talk about in Leaving God Behind is Canada's definition of marriage. Like the Canada's definition of marriage was struck down. It was an explicitly Christian definition of marriage that was struck down by the Ontario Court of Appeal in 2003 and then changed by legislation afterwards. But the Canada's definition of marriage was based on a British court decision from the 19th century. So from the time we were independent until 2003, our definition of marriage was an explicitly Christian definition of marriage that was written into a British court decision. And so I asked people, if, you know, we our country cannot be under the obligations given to us by another country, how is it that our definition of marriage for more than 100 years was a British court decision? So it shows the principles that Canada and the other Anglosphere nations, we adopted these laws and court principles and so on from Britain, and they fully applied here, even though we hadn't created them ourselves. They were a carryover. And so I wanted to show that continuity between, you know, certain legal principles and the Solomon Covenant. So that was kind of a subtle way of arguing in favor of the Solomon Covenant through that book. Also too, I think as people understand more, like, there's so many Christians who think that we got our freedoms from the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Like I run into people, they think, well, the Charter of Rights and Freedom, this is our source of our freedoms and our, you know, in our country. And I'm like, you know, no, I mean, it wasn't adopted until 1982. And so what about all the freedom we had before then? Like I was born long before that. And I had freedoms, all kinds of freedoms. I remember when the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was brought in, it didn't expand my freedoms at all. And as I explained in that book, I think gradually it actually takes away from what our country really was. I think it's turned our country in a bad direction and has been harmful. But I'm trying to help people understand that the Charter of Rights and Freedoms isn't something that they should be, especially if they're Christians, it's not something that they should be praising. I mean, it's in effect now. And so when we do have court cases, we have to use it. Like, you know, I'm not saying we can't use it. I mean, Christian lawyers have to use that even when they're defending us right now. But there is better principles. We had better principles before. And in a future state, presumably with a revival, when Canada, more Canadians turn to Christianity, we can have a better system than the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I'd like to point out too, I mean, I'm not sure, you might be too young to remember Pierre Trudeau, but you know, a lot of us, especially out west, have bad memories of Pierre Trudeau. He had a very socialistic background. You know, he was probably the most important prime minister of my lifetime in the sense of the changes that he made in this country. And there's many people out here who you know, have bad memories of him, and yet they think he did something good with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I'm thinking, well, you know, here's this guy who you think so bad, and yet you think he changed our constitution for the better. And I just, you know, I don't think he did. And I explained, like with Leaving God Behind, I use various examples of how the Charter of Rights, as soon as it was brought into power, started overturning Canada's various Christian laws and policies that we had. Canada had explicitly Christian laws and policies, such as one of the big examples I use is the Lord's Day Act, which was, you know, legislated in 1906 specifically so that Canada would have you know, the fourth commandment or the Sabbath, you know, it would be officially recognized by law in Canada. And that was overturned by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And also there was in Ontario had very Christian education policies. Of course, they weren't fully implemented anymore as time went on and people turned away from Christianity. But the religious exercises, such as, you know, prayer and Bible reading in schools, that was thrown out because of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There was some Christian explicitly Christian doctrinal teaching in some cases in Ontario schools, and that was thrown out because of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I mentioned Canada's explicitly Christian definition of marriage was thrown out. So the Charter did so much to overturn Canada's Christian foundation, and that's kind of the theme of the book for the most part. And I think that Trudeau has, you know, I don't know how much he envisioned the overturning of the Christian basis per se, but he certainly wanted to change the country. Trudeau did not like the country, but when he was prime minister, he didn't like the country the way it was, and he wanted to fundamentally transform the country. And adopting the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was his way of transforming the country. And he did. I mean, and it's still transforming the country today. So there's a sense in which Pierre Trudeau rules Canada from the grave through, you know, the charter that he instituted that's being interpreted in ways, you know, that have kind of undermined traditional values and other things with it that we've had in Canada over the decades.
Now, thank you so much, Michael. I really enjoy spending this time with you, and definitely I look forward to having you back with us on the podcast for future episodes to dive deeper into your books. It's fascinating to see our Christian heritage, our Christian history. It's incredible to see that so many different vestiges of our Christian social order of our founding fathers. I remember it was the American historian Mark Knoll who wrote in his book Christianity in Canada, and he was saying that Canada was more Christian and more Orthodox in its Christianity than the United States ever was. And so I would think that we have a very firm and strong foundation. We might be perhaps perceived as the liberal capital of the world, so to speak, in terms of the progressive woke and cultural Marxist direction that we've been taking as a culture. But we also have a very bright heritage that we can embrace and that we can learn from and that we can pick up from and move forward with the Word of God as our very foundation, as our guiding principle, and praying that as long as there is a faithful church that is at work, working together with, as a united body for the glory of God and advancing God's kingdom through its proclamation of the gospel and its application of its graces and how it relates to every sphere of life, we'll be able to see renewal that we're promised in God's word. So, Michael, thank you so much. I'm really encouraged by your work, your ministry. I'm counting the days the next time I can visit Alberta because we went there a couple of years back, and we didn't go up as far up as Edmonton. We were down in the Calgary area, had a chance to go to Drumheller, Dinosaur Provincial Park, Banff. Beautiful province, absolutely beautiful province. And I mean, we're here in the Niagara region of Ontario, where it is quite picturesque with our vineyards and all that sort of stuff. So we're very thankful where the Lord has placed us, but I can't say that I don't covet your scenery over there. Geography and just wonderful to see what God's handiwork in where you live. And God bless you. God bless your family. Thank you for being with us. Is there anything you want to say to our listeners before we close our time together?
Well, just since you offered, one of the things you mentioned, like when you mentioned Mark Knowles and his comparison of Canada and the United States and the Christian heritage, that reminded me, like one of the themes too of Leaving God Behind is I wanted people to know that Canada did have that rich Christian heritage, because there are people who asked me in the past, you know, which book can you show me that Canada was a Christian country in the past? And like, there's so many American books. So the Americans have so much historical data on the Christian heritage of the United States. And I didn't see that in Canada. And so that was kind of an underlying theme too for Leaving God Behind, to show that we were founded as a Christian country. We had Christian laws and policies. Of course, the charter overturned all that, and that's part of the book too. But I want Canadians to know that there is information available to show that we had a Christian basis to our country as much as or more than the United States.
Thank you so much, Michael, and to all of you who are listening in. Until next time, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review as well as we continue to move forward and expanding this podcast. For those of you who have been with us since the beginning, you'll realize there have been some slight changes and adjustments with regards to our facing as we enter the year of 2024. We are looking to drastically improve our quantity and our quality of production. And so, thank you so much for supporting us, for listening in, and we look forward to reaching you again soon.
The Apologist is a podcast of the Cantaro Institute, inheriting, informing, inspiring. As a registered charity, we impact countless around the world with our digital and print resources, thanks to your generous support and donations. We can't do this without you. Consider becoming a partner today. Visit www.cantaroinstitute.org/donate. Until next time, all rights reserved.